once again, folks, to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And oh, man.
Wait, hold on.
What?
This isn't right. It's like 103. I don't think we're allowed to start until at least 115. I'm pretty sure that we have set that precedent on this show.
No, you have set that precedence as of last week.
Ow, burn.
That was your fault, not mine.
That was not my fault.
Yeah, it was, because you were late.
I was only a little late. I thought I left plenty of time. Traffic was bad.
Yeah, well, still your fault. I'm blaming traffic on you.
That's fair.
So, anyway, we have stuff that's going on.
Yeah, we do.
Namely, contest!
Yes, a contest.
As we announced last week, we have a $50 Amazon gift card on the line for anybody who can present us with a better intro than what we've got now.
Which, I mean, I'm pretty sure you guys can do. I have faith in our listeners that this is a thing they can make happen.
I have faith, too. If I didn't have faith, I wouldn't be offering a $50 Amazon gift card for it to happen. There are a couple stipulations, though. There are just a few.
All right.
A small little a list, if you will. So you must be 18 years older to enter. All entries have to be in MP3 format. Please keep your entries shorter than a minute 30, so 90 seconds or less.
Bob's computer will explode if you send him a WAV file.
MP3 is just easier to deal with as far as my equipment's concerned. Must have a valid email address. And the entry deadline is August 31st at 8 p.m. Pacific and 11 p.m. Eastern. So, yeah. Keeping those things in mind, you can submit all entries to allthingstrek@hotmail.com. Apparently, I'm coming in a little low. That's no good. Let's go into our devices and stuff and start looking at why that is the way it is.
Maybe we're just sitting too far away from the mic?
Could be. Maybe if we boost the gain?
The gain is boosted.
The gain
now,
is boosted.
Now the levels say we're louder. Are we too loud?
Hope not.
All right, just I guess you should maybe repeat the important part of that of those rules, because some people might not have heard.
It's true. All right, so we have a contest going on. $50 Amazon gift card can be yours. All you got to do is send us an entry to allthingstrek@hotmail.com with your entry. Here's what needs to happen, though, in order for you to be eligible for your entry. You have to be 18 years or older. All entries must be in MP3 format. Please keep it shorter than a minute 30, 90 seconds or less. Must have a valid email address. And your entry deadline is August 31st, 8 p.m. Pacific and 11 p.m. Eastern. Now, that doesn't exclude anybody who's overseas.
No.
Like people in the UK, Europe, Japan, if we have Chinese listeners.
Wherever you live,
you can go ahead and submit, and you are eligible for this contest.
Although I'm a little curious how they would submit us an entry without a valid email address. I'm kind of imagining someone dropping like an anonymous letter under your door with like a CD.
That's possible. That's a thing.
That would be CD.
Yeah, it's just more for our benefit to be able to say, you know, it came from this email address, and it is such and such that has won. So.
Okay, all right.
But yeah. We have that going on. Remember, $50 Amazon gift card will be available to the winner, which you can only use on Amazon.com. So it's not you can't use on Amazon.co.uk, for instance.
Really?
However,
that's unfortunate.
If you do like live in the UK or Europe, you can use the gift card on Amazon.com though, if you want to, because they ship everywhere in the world.
That's weird.
I did some research into it just to make sure that it
I
was.
I gave up trying to understand Amazon a while back.
Well, the contest is available to international audiences. It's not a United States only thing, thankfully.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, there's something you wanted to say about the GNT contest?
I just wanted to, for anyone who doesn't also listen to the GNT show, which is a podcast hosted like Sunday mornings by our friends Terry Lynn and Gettysburg 7.
Friends.
I think we're friends.
How did you describe it? We have an incestuous relationship with.
I wasn't going to say that on air.
Tribbles and Ecstasy. And...
Well, it's us, at Tribbles and Ecstasy podcast, UGC, and Gettysburg 7. And the GNT show. We all kind of share a host in some capacity or another. But anyway, they're doing a contest right now for a short audio fiction having to do with the Kobayashi Maru.
Yes.
You can find all the exact rules over on their site. I know that it has to be 5 minutes or less. I don't remember exactly when the due date is. I know they're going to start accepting entries on Memorial Day.
That due dates. You think in such three-dimensional terms.
Hey.
Wah, wah, wah,
rude.
Wah, 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 wah.
But anyway, and you can. I think you submit it to hosts at GNT show, or host. Wait, no, okay. I don't actually know their email address.
We'll just go over to their website, gntshow.com, and you'll be able to find all the rules and how to submit to their contest over there.
And I'm putting together an official entry for All Things Trek.
Oh, snap. Are we eligible to win?
Yes. You're not on the GNT show, Bob. You've ruined my hopes of ever winning a podcast UGC, contest by being on that show.
Well, hold on. To be fair, Podcast UGC's contest had a Galar class, or has a Galar class, as the winning thing, right?
Right.
Now, you don't play Star Trek Online.
No, I have no way to accept it, because you're on their podcast now.
You had no plan of playing Star Trek Online unless an ambassador class was introduced.
No, but it was going to be yours. I was going to give it to you. You were going to accept it in my place, but now you can't do that because you're the host.
I don't want the Galar class.
You said you wanted the phaser thingies that it has.
Yeah, like a very vain whim.
Yeah, whatever. It's a Galar class.
Cool,
but is anyone
it.
Actually going to fly this thing around as anything other than a, look, I've got this Galar class?
Some people do.
I mean, is it good? I was led to believe it wasn't a very good ship. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
I don't know. I've heard people comment that it's kind of similar to the Excelsior in its capabilities.
Really? All right, well...
Which, you know, Excelsior blow up Sovereign at 30 phases.
Well, regardless of... I'm putting together an entry for the G&T show contest because I'm eligible for that one. And it's...
I'm sorry I'm ruining these things
fun,
for you.
I like making audio dramas, and it's fun to make a nice short one.
Okay, all right.
So I think we have one more contest thing to announce, which is actually from one of our listeners.
Oh, is that from Wayne?
Yeah, Wayne, our good friend...
Wayne Bosta.
Yeah,
it's right here.
Here we go. This is the one.
Did we get a second email about it?
Yeah, he responded to my response.
Ah, I gotcha.
But anyway, he has a new book out called, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right... actually, no, Bob, you pronounce it. I'm bad at pronouncing names.
Aristia?
Yeah, Aristia, A Little Rebellion, which is another... Which, first of all, congratulations to him for having, like, not just one book out, but several books. Writing books is hard and takes a lot of work, so that's awesome. And he's doing, like, a blog tour to promote the book. It comes out on June 1st, and until the 15th, he's running a contest in which you can win a number of things, including, like, a hardback copy... of every book currently in publication, which includes Dying of the Light, Aristia Revolutionary Right, Aristia A Little Rebellion, and A Fancy Dinner Party, or a signed hardback copy of... Hey, go back to that page. I was still reading that page. a signed hardback copy of Aristia Revolutionary Right and Aristia A Little Rebellion, a signed hardback copy of Just A Little Rebellion, and then a signed paperback copy or an ebook or a couple of short stories. So this is pretty cool stuff. I want these things.
Which is the book that he has coming out here is the sequel to A Little Rebellion, correct?
No, I think it is A Little Rebellion. It's a sequel to the previous one.
Revolutionary Right.
Yes, sequel to Revolutionary Right. And so you can enter a couple...
If you win our contest with your Amazon gift card, you can totally buy Revolutionary Right.
Which you totally should.
Yeah,
if you win our contest.
Yeah,
but you can enter into Wayne's contest by leaving a relevant comment on his blog, and that's just comment on something that he has blogged about, and as long as it's not like a spam post, you will be entered into the contest. You can participate in the Aristia, am I saying that right? Aristia blog tour, which you can also find on his blog.
Can you please send us a pronunciation guide?
But you can find that on his blog too. And then he has a pre-launch blitz, which is also on his blog, and I was a little unclear on exactly how that works, but it looked pretty cool. Or you can tweet about it. And if you use the hashtag @Aristia...
Which is the number sign or pound.
Or not at, excuse me, yeah, the hashtags. I don't understand hashtags, okay?
It's a Twitter thing. You wouldn't understand.
We're just having this conversation about how Twitter is, like, too advanced for me. I can't be creative enough to use Twitter.
I think it's more so just because of the way Twitter works, which is, as I pointed out, has a lot of mundane things on it. You just can't bring yourself down to that level of thinking of mundane term.
I suppose.
I think
it would be easier for me to have my own Twitter account than for me to have the All Things Trek Twitter account, because I feel like I should be saying relevant Star Trek things on the All Things Trek Twitter account. Or if it was just me, I could be like, I had a soda, my car is an interesting color, there's a bird outside.
That sounds about right for Twitter.
But anyway.
There's a bird outside.
So you should totally...
Ah, Twitter, bird, I get it.
You should totally check out Wayne Bosta's contest, because his books look really cool.
Yep.
And in fact, they are next up on my reading list as soon as I finish the Discworld book I'm currently on.
Bam.
All right. And so with that all done, we have a couple of emails.
We do have a couple of emails.
All right. The first one I'm really excited about because Bob is getting called out and not me. I am so happy.
Well, you get to read it.
I'm going to read it. This is from our good friend Johnny Q. Hi, guys. Disclosure. I took the liberty of listening to episode 46 in its entirety before composing this email.
Well, good on you.
Smiley face. At Bob. I have to emphatically disagree with a statement you made regarding J.J. Abrams' various TV series. You said, well, it is mysterious, it's just not a well-constructed narrative. I'd have to agree with Oren that labeling JJ's various series as mysterious is far too generous. Throwing random, inexplicable elements into a TV series doesn't make it mysterious any more than throwing random ingredients into a frying pan would make a dish exotic. One of the key elements of a mystery is the process of connecting a series of clues to deduce a logical conclusion. When the elements are not designed with a conclusion in mind, it's not mysterious, it's simply contrived, and poorly so. See Polar Bears and Jacob in Lost, and Rimbaldi Artifacts in Alias, which I've not been able to watch Alias so far. I'm kind of curious about that. And when Abrams boxes himself into a corner with his disjointed elements, he defaults to the overused trope of alternate universe. See Lost, Fringed, and to a lesser extent, Star Trek. I know this isn't all things JJ, but I had to interject. It hit a nerve. Smiley face, cheers.
Well, you know, in response, I would have to say that you had to listen to the entire sentence, I suppose, to understand what I said.
Oh.
Which is, well, it is a mystery. It's just not a well-constructed narrative. Which, I love the fact that you went on in the next paragraph to talk about how these things are not well-constructed narratives. Which is true. Which is exactly what I said.
Well, it's...
I think the hang-up is on the word mysterious here, which is quoted several times, mind you, through the next preceding paragraph in the email. Which, just the word mysterious, that's just... the actual definition of mysterious is just something that cannot be explained.
All right.
That's it for mystery, which, you know, a lot of things that JJ does can't be explained. So they're mysterious.
I certainly have no explanation for a lot of them. But regardless, I'm just happy that you got called out and not me. This is a good week for me.
This was just an exercise in picking up the Merriam-Webster dictionary.
All right.
That's what this was.
Thank you for the email, Johnny Q. We look forward to the next one. Oh, and
right.
we have another one.
We do have another one.
From our friend Chris. Bob, you read this one.
All right. Dear Bob and Oren, this is probably on a more superficial level than what you two usually cover. Well, I don't know about that.
It's because he listened to our last episode with Kathy, and she was all deep and philosophical.
It's true.
He has a weird idea of what we're about.
Ms. Ferguson does, in fact, bring this show to a level that it doesn't consistently hold a lot of the time. But I hope it's interesting enough for your tastes. When it comes to Star Trek, it comes naturally that most people who like it enjoy it, enjoy its aesthetics, especially the starships that boldly go. I've heard previously that Bob's favorite canon starship class is the Excelsior class, while having some non-canon favorites from the Starfleet Command game, such as the Acula class, which I think that's how you say that. I think it's Acula or Acula. I'm not sure which one it is.
I'm going to say Acula, because it sounds like Bacula, but without the B.
So you instantly hate it, right?
Maybe.
It's been also stated that Oren's favorite is the Ambassador class. But why do you like them? What drew you to these specific types of ships in Trek? Why the Excelsior class and not Oberth class? Or the Acula class and not Okinawa class for the non-canon game route? Why the on-screen ambassador, not Andrew Probert's original design that showed up in this year's Ships of the Line calendar? Is it easy to describe why if you're asked this? Or is there some aspect to your favorite ship that you can't quite put your finger on? Yet still like it. In any case, thank you both for the show. Sincerely, Chris.
Well, I can tell you straight off why I don't like the Oberth class. It's a space canoe. It's like a canoe with like a thing on the top of it. I just think it looks really goofy, personally.
Yeah, I couldn't really quite figure out what... When I first saw the Oberth class, which my first exposure to actually I think was in TNG, which I couldn't figure out at the time kind of what the design of it was supposed to be. You know, like, what is the thing on the bottom? Is it a warp nacelle?
Yeah.
You know, is that more, like, living space? You know, what is it? Then what are those little two fringe things on the top at the where the bridge is supposed to be? Are those the warp nacelles?
Yeah, those are the nacelles, which is the weird thing about the Oberth class, because I don't know how canon this is, but I always assumed that the reason why nacelles were farther back, away from the rest of the ship, is because they would explode or something. And so, like, you know, having the nacelles right next to the main part of the ship didn't sound like a good idea to me. Maybe that's why it exploded in Star Trek III.
I don't know. Just
a crippling design.
I might have run out of a tech manual or so, but as far as warp nacelles go, the reason that they're placed kind of away from the hull is because of the radiation field that they produce when they're going to warp. So that flash effect, for instance.
Well, there you go. You don't want that right next to the bridge.
But then we have things like the Defiant, right? Where it's like the nacelles are like tucked right up next to the hull.
Whatever. They shunt the nacelles through Sisko's hatred of the Borg. Whatever. I hate the Defiant.
As for why I like the Excelsior, initially I didn't like the Excelsior at all. In fact, I hated that ship initially.
Well, you're supposed to hate it. Star Trek III tells you to hate it because it's trying to replace the Enterprise.
Yeah, exactly. But as I grew older, I came to appreciate the Excelsior more because it was the only ship that we had seen that has an actual life cycle that we've seen more or less from the birth of it to almost its death, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in a Nemesis. It's, what, like 100-some years old now at that point?
Is there an Excelsior in Nemesis?
I don't think there's specifically one in there, but we see on the diagram where the Enterprise is fleeing Romulan space, he's going to cross the Barzon, or not Barzon, the
Nebula.
Basin Rift or something like that. And they're going to rendezvous with a fleet, and one of the ships is the USS Hood. Now, we know the USS Hood it has been, at least at one point in TNG, an Excelsior-class ship commanded by Robert DeSoto.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, it's possible that they're at least still in service. So we saw them during the Dominion War. So it's a ship that has served out many years in Starfleet, you know, has had a distinctive service record, and we know there are a lot of them constructed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a workhorse-type ship, and that's what attracts me a lot to it as just a ship. Then I think just a lot of the lines it has, as I've grown older, I've come to appreciate it. I think it looks like a very sturdy vessel. When I think of a lot of actions that take place within the Star Trek universe, I typically am putting an Excelsior-class starship in a lot of those events that happen.
Yeah.
Just because of that, because I think of it as such a workhorse starship. The Acula kind of falls into that same category for me, at least as far as like the Starfleet Command games goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the way it is. And actually, as for like the Okinawa class, funny enough, for that, we actually finished playing the Star Trek RPG, what, 4 months ago? Months ago?
4 or 5 months ago.
Where Oren was the GM, and he needed a ship that was going to be like a patrol-type vessel. And at first you were thinking Miranda.
Yeah, but then I figured out a Miranda has like 200 people on board, and I was like, that's a bigger ship than I want. And then I told Bob it was going to be an Oberth, and Bob was like, oh no. And then he came up with this other idea.
Check out this Okinawa class I found, bro.
And I was like, yeah, the Okinawa is exactly what I wanted.
I enjoyed the design decision you made, which is to put a staircase in it.
Yeah, it's only got 5 decks. It's got 1 turbo lift and 2 staircases.
Unlike most people, I don't like Probert's ambassador class design. Have you seen it?
I've seen both, but I'm hard-pressed to remember which one is which.
Okay, well, I'll show you really quick. Like, Probert tends to look a lot more proto-galaxy class,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to looking like the galaxy class and Excelsior were mashed together. Let me see if I can find it with this thing.
Yeah.
Google images, don't fail me now.
I think images. It might just be that I'm not visually... Oh, that?
Yeah, this thing.
Oh, ew. I hate that. I hate it, like, immediately. Ew. Get it off. Get it off the screen.
Okay,
I don't want to see it.
It's on the screen anymore.
Okay,
anymore.
I was wrong. I had never seen that before. I thought I had seen it, but that was a lie.
Yeah, like, I don't like the lines of that one so much. In fact, I think it is more indicative of perhaps some of the design decisions we see in Star Trek Online. I think personally, with the way, especially like what kind of looks like the back end of it with the nacelles, how they kind of sweep up on the pylons.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, I've only seen it from one particular perspective, which is kind of if you were the ship that was off its port bow and you're looking mm-hmm. at it, that's kind of the perspective you're looking at it from, which is the left and front for those that don't know Navy slang or whatever.
Everyone knows Navy slang.
Or maritime slang, whatever you want to term it as. But, yeah.
Well, I mean,
I'm not a fan of the Probert design myself.
Yeah, neither am I after actually looking at
it. After seeing the thing.
All right, so the thing, I mean, the Probert, and this is possibly just the fact that I've gotten used to the one that we saw in yesterday's Enterprise. Maybe if I'd seen the Probert design first, I wouldn't have had that reaction. But I like the Ambassador as it was shown in TNG, both because I really liked yesterday's Enterprise. It's a really good episode. I really love the story of the Enterprise C. I think that's just a really good story, just in general. And I liked the way the Ambassador looked, because if there was one thing that bothered me about the Enterprise D, it was that I thought its saucer section was too big. Like, its saucer section seemed a little out of proportion with the rest of the ship. And I liked that the Ambassador class seemed a little bit more compact. It had a smaller saucer section relative to its drive. The nacelles didn't seem to be out quite as far. It just seemed like a more space-efficient ship just from looking at it.
Uh-huh.
And I also, I'm not a huge fan of the direction that newer Starfleet ships have been, because they all have to look sleeker and sexier. And I'm just like, eh, I liked Star Trek ships when they didn't look sleek. I liked them when they looked kind of blocky.
When you say new ones, you're talking about like the movie ships, right?
Well, like the, you know, starting with the Sovereign, and to a lesser extent, some of the newer ships we saw in DS9, like the Akira.
Akira wasn't really that new, though.
Well, it was new in DS9.
I mean, we saw it in DS9.
We saw it towards the end of the Dominion.
Manuals and stuff, it was started being produced in, like, the 2350s.
Manuals can say what they want. They're not real. The point is that the Akira was effectively brand new from watching the show, because we'd never seen an Akira before until fairly late into the Dominion War. And if they had them around, why weren't they using them at the beginning of the Dominion War? So it was, for all intents and purposes, they're new. And some tech manual might say otherwise, but that tech manual is wrong.
If there's one ship I really dislike, it's the Saber.
The what?
The Saber class.
What is the Saber class
right.
look like?
All right, so more Google image action time for Oren here.
You know, that Google, that search bar, like, the address bar is also a search bar, Bob. You don't have to go directly to Google. And
no, I refuse to use your sleeker starship, Oren.
This is Chrome. Chrome has more functionality.
This is the Saber.
Oh.
Oh, wait a minute. Apparently this is a phishing site.
Oh.
We won't go there. Here. That's the Saber.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of ugly.
Which we saw them in First Contact.
Did we?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah,
the Steamrunner is also a bizarre-looking ship.
Yeah, it's kind of weird when you see ships that have nacelles that close to the hull. I don't know. I'm not a huge fan of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's why I like the Ambassador. I think it's a lot to do with the episode I saw it in. So you know, I'm a fan of it for that reason.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, it's a lot of it is aesthetics. Like, and you know, there I don't hate the Sovereign or the newer ships. I just liked them before when they were less kind of stereotypically movie sci-fi-ish. I like ships that don't look... That aren't beautiful. I like ships that are... You know, like, elegant is cool, but, like, ships that look like they've been deliberately designed for aerodynamics have always kind of bothered me, because it's in space.
Yeah, you don't really need aerodynamics in space so much.
Yeah, clearly these ships were not designed for atmospheric flight, so there's not really any reason for them to be aerodynamic. Nebula dynamic, maybe, I don't know.
What does that mean?
Well, like...
Nebula dynamic?
Well, Star Trek has always displayed nebulas as being giant, like, clouds of gas, being, like, really dense. So,
yeah.
Like, maybe your hydrodynamics, for lack of a better word, would actually matter if you were moving through a Star Trek nebula. Fairly certain that's not how real nebulas work, but what have you.
Well, anyway.
All right. So I hope that answers your email. Chris, please send us more emails.
I heard word in the street that you heard that Janeway was excited to shoot Paris down.
Oh, yeah, okay, so this was a funny thing. So I think I've mentioned a couple of times that I've been watching, catching up on the Voyager and Enterprise episodes I haven't seen, because there are some that I hadn't seen.
Right.
And I'd never gotten to watch 30 Days all the way through.
Now, this one I don't recall.
30 Days is the episode where Paris gets demoted to ensign.
Oh, yes, where he's in the brig.
Yeah.
Yes.
And, like, there's this kind of, it's got a lot of weird things going on, like, the connection between... Because, like, the problem is that there's this planet, there's this water planet, basically, and it's got, like, it's having a problem because the reactor that's holding it all together is failing because they're mining too much oxygen out of the water.
Uh-huh.
And the connection between the oxygen mining and the reactor failing is, like, one very vague line of dialogue that you could very easily miss and not have any idea why the oxygen mining is causing the reactor to fail.
Uh-huh.
So that part is kind of weird. Also, they are, for some reason, really, really hesitant to shoot the giant fish monster that's wrecking them. And it's like, guys, come on. I don't like killing things for no reason either, but this is a giant fish monster that's wrecking your ship. Just shoot it already. I'm sorry. But, so there's that whole thing. But then, like, towards the end, Paris, like, you know, they tell these people, you have to stop mining this oxygen or your water planet will explode. And they're like, whatever. It's probably not a big deal. You know,
eco-conservatist mumbo-jumbo.
You know, it's caused by cow farts or what have you. So at that point, Janeway is like, well... And in one of the few times that I like, you know, Janeway's decision prime directive-wise, she's like, well, I mean, you know, they're being short-sighted, but at the same time, it's not our job to tell them how to run their planet. Like, we've given them the information. It's up to them to decide what to do with it. But Paris is like, nah, no, no, sir. So he teams up with another one of the aliens, and they're
so
like, we're going to go...
He's medic, commando team leader, helmsman, and conservationist now.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
And so he teams... Well, because he... In this episode, he spontaneously develops a love of the sea, which he'd never had before, which was a little weird, but whatever. So, like, he teams up with this other alien, and they're like, we're going to go eco-terrorists on these guys. We're going to blow up these oxygen refineries.
Okay. All right.
And so they do that, and like, and the apparently the aliens whose ships, this is something I always thought was strange, was that these aliens have apparently really, really crappy ships that, even though they're specifically designed to go underwater, the Delta Flyer can just go lower than them. And like, I don't know, I thought that was a little strange.
If you're out of power of the structural integrity field, you can do anything.
I guess the Delta Flyer was originally designed to go into a gas giant, but...
Was it really?
Mm-hmm. That was why they built it.
Well, there we go.
But anyway, so they go to do that, and like Janeway's in the position where she basically has to stop them because they're breaking the Federation law, and so she's like, you know, and it's like, all right, well, we have to shoot them down. It's the only way to stop them. And at that point, Kim like turns to her and is like, Captain, that's Tom. We're not really going to shoot at him, are we? And Janeway says something to the effect of, as far as I'm concerned, he forfeited his protection as a member of this crew the moment he stole that shuttle. But the way that she says it, like, her delivery makes her sound excited. Like, she is
smiling when
really
she says it?
Eager to... Not quite smiling, but she's got, like... I don't know, she sounds kind of hungry almost. She's, like, excited to shoot Paris down. Like, she's been waiting for this chance. And it's just like, oh, that's... That's a little disturbing. I don't really know what the director was thinking there. I'm not really sure what the intent of that, of the way they delivered that line was.
Maybe the entire time it's been a facade, how she's actually been treating Tom better because she hates him so much, but she doesn't want that to be evident to the rest of the crew.
That's possible.
So now she feels she has her chance to finally get rid of him.
I mean, I don't know. It was just really strange and bizarre. Speaking of things that are strange and bizarre, so it's looking more and more likely that that Khan is going to be the villain of the next Star Trek movie, played by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yep.
And this has not been released through an official source yet. This has all been released through TrekMovie.com. I have no idea what TrekMovie.com's track record is in terms of being able to, like, you know, call movies.
Uh-huh.
But a lot, they're very confident, and they say that they have a source that makes them confident. I don't know what that source is. They haven't told us what that source is.
We should get a source like that.
Well, I...
For things.
I
say
totally
stuff.
Have a source. My source is confident. So, I mean, it's a thing where, like, I don't know for sure, but it's looking more likely. I won't believe it 100% until I'm actually sitting in the theaters. But, like, assuming it is true, I'm having... I don't know. I expected to be mad, but I'm having a hard time, like, summoning the energy to be mad at this point.
Uh-huh.
Because everything I've been hearing about this movie is just kind of like, oh, well, it's another thing that maybe it's true, and maybe it will be weird. And, I mean, I think I'm...
As long as there's no time travel shenanigans stuff,
It's like
I'm willing to give it kind of a shot to see where it goes.
It's like I'm not mad, I'm just a little confused, is what it is, because it's like, I don't really see the point of bringing in Khan, because it's like, everyone who has actually seen Star Trek 2, at this point you're just setting your movie up for failure, because, like, you know, they're just going to compare it to Star Trek 2, and even if by some chance it is as good as Star Trek 2, no one will ever admit that. And for the people who haven't seen Star Trek 2, what's a con? Like,
what's a con?
What is a con?
Maybe it's going to be, like, Space Seed. I mean, because remember, the whole... Part of the premise of Wrath of Khan was that Khan had already been exiled by Kirk. Now, in this Star Trek 2, mind you, they haven't met yet.
Yeah, exactly.
At all. Because we're still talking... I mean, I don't know when the movie's going to take place, whether it's going to be during the actual voyages of the 2260s or whatever it is that they're doing, right? Mid-2260s. Or if it's going to be right after, you know, Kirk is taking command of the Enterprise, which we're talking then, you know, 2258, 59.
It's going to be weird if it's set significantly later, because the actors have only gotten 4 years older. it's going to be weird if the show is, like, 15 years down the line or what have you.
I don't know. We don't know what those details are, and, I mean, makeup.
Yeah, I guess.
You know.
Well, also, considering that they made him captain at the end of the last movie, it's probably not going to be that long, because, like, you know, how long is he going to be in command of this one ship?
Yeah. Again, all things we don't know. But if it's going to be a first encounter, I imagine that if Khan is going to be the main villain, which I've heard, you know, rumors that he's not, he's going to be a minor villain. I'm not sure how that's going to work out.
Someone said that, but I haven't really been able to track down any even kind of quasi-source on that. I think that's just something that manifested out of the ether. Although if someone has a source, I'd like to see it. I heard someone say that, but I don't think it's based on anything.
Yeah, but if that's true, it definitely would feel like Star Trek would be kind of going the way of, like, you know how the Spider-Man reboot movies had, like, several villains in their movies.
Oh, you mean like Spider-Man 3, how it had like three villains?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Like you have Khan, then someone else.
Well, the thing about it is that like by introducing Khan into this movie, now like suddenly it is just going to have to work way harder to impress me because like, you know, the Khan in this movie isn't going to have the same significance as the Khan from Wrath of Khan because they've never met before. So like either this is going to be like, I mean, I could maybe see an entire movie made out of Space Seed the episode.
Or, or check this. Let's go into speculation lane for a bit here.
All right.
Say we have, I mean, especially since we, there seems to be kind of a Romulan motif that's been occurring since Nemesis, right? And because we have, like, Enterprise that had, you know, a lot of Romulan shenanigans in its fourth season, which were good shenanigans. I actually kind of dug those shenanigans despite some of the anachronistic errors that occurred in there.
If you say so.
I enjoyed the story that was there for that.
I won't fight you.
We also had the Enterprise movie. that's a thought, isn't it?
It's a thought. It's not a good thought,
the
though.
2009 Star Trek movie had Nero, who was a Romulan, with his Borgified Romulan mining ship causing problems, right? Blowing up Vulcan, then going on to try to blow up Earth.
I think you mean his, like, space sea urchin.
Yes, the space sea urchin. And then we have, let's say for this movie, we have, oh, what's the name of the Romulan commander from TOS in the Enterprise incident? What's her name?
Oh, I don't remember. Oh, from the Enterprise incident? I don't remember her name, but she's awesome.
But imagine we have her, and she finds, like, Khan's ship, that DY 500 class, whatever it was, right?
The Botany Bay?
The Botany Bay, in the sleeper ship. She finds all these human augments and decides to unleash them.
Huh.
Check that.
Because
the Klingons were very interested in all the augment DNA stuff from Enterprise, right? Which, granted, is 100-some years before this. Imagine if the Romulans had caught a hold of some of that kind of stuff.
All right, I could see it. I didn't know that. That's a thought. I think that, I don't know.
I mean, so that in that way, Khan is still present in the film, but he's not the main bad guy so much as being a henchman. Which, I mean, I don't know if that would necessarily qualify as a disservice to Khan, but at the same time, how do you match or top Ricardo Montalban? Right?
Yeah,
because he did such an awesome job with Khan.
I could see this being a movie with, well, like, I could see this, you know, Khan being, like, the muscle to the Romulan commander's arch-villain status. I could see that, and that could work. Yeah, I mean, I could buy it. Again, I'm not writing this movie off yet. It's definitely not something that makes me excited, but I'm not going to go and say that the movie is doomed because Khan is in it.
Uh-huh.
It's just kind of a choice that I would not have made were I making this movie. But then again, I suppose I'm looking at it from the perspective of how do I make the best movie that I want to see as opposed to how do I get the most people into a theater. And I guess dropping Khan might get you some more butts in seats. I don't know. I'm not sure if it would... You might also lose a couple of people who are like, it's just going to be Star Trek 2 again.
Well, with the line of thinking I think that's occurring with, you know, the Bad Robot production team and, you know, Paramount and all that, is that they very much want to appeal to both audiences, but I think they're trying too hard to try to name drop things and put in too much stuff that is recognizable. And they're trying so hard to the point that it may cause people who are fans of the franchise already to go, WTF. What's going on here? This is silly.
Yeah, I suppose that's possible. I think that
that's why it's very important that Khan be done in such a way. I mean, because we're dealing with this alternate universe thing, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so the fact that we're name-dropping Khan, us who are Trek fans are familiar with Khan, would like to see him portrayed in a way that was similar to what we saw in Space Sea at the very least, because that character is already established, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't around for those 200 years of history.
Yeah, his character hasn't been changed. Nero didn't kill his dad.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just important that are Kurtzman and Orsi writing this one?
Yeah, same people.
And so it's important that they keep that in mind and not change what has already come before in terms of character and all that for Khan, while at the same time still producing a good story that's going to appeal to everybody, because we're still dealing with the movie that they want to have be standalone.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure is their goal.
Yeah, probably. Alright, well, I don't know. It'll be interesting. I'll probably go see it. I might rage about it afterwards.
Well, that's, you already are going to. It doesn't matter what it is.
Yeah, that's true. But, like,
let's be real, Orange.
There will definitely be things about it I don't like. But the question now is, will it be like Star Trek 2009, where it's like, there was a lot of stuff I didn't like, but I liked the movie in spite of all of those things?
All the lens flare. All of it.
Or is it going to be a movie that is just crap? That is sort of, I don't know. We'll see. And I don't know. I'm starting to really resent J.J. Abrams' form of advertising, where he'll like release a bunch of misinformation, because it's sort of hard to get passionate about something that might not be true.
Yeah. So this is true.
I'm sort of getting annoyed at that, and I wish he would stop. I know he's not going to, because he's really good at it and it makes a lot of money. But I wish he would.
Yeah.
All right.
So we have a topic for today.
Yeah, we do, and it's not monsters. No, wait, no, it is monsters.
It is monsters.
It's monsters, and maybe children if we run out of monster material. Because
well, the same thing, right? Zing,
bam. All right. Because there's been like a couple of monsters in Star Trek, although not as many as I thought. Like when I first floated this topic, I thought I'd have a whole list of episodes, but as I was looking, I could only find a few.
What are we defining as monster exactly? Are we talking just the aesthetic of a monster, where it's like woolly booly booly billion tentacles kind of monster? Are we talking monster in terms of personality and what they're trying to do within the plot?
Well, I would define a monster in this context a couple of different ways. Like, you could just go with, you know, a weird, crazy monster alien thing. Or you could also go the Jason Voorhees route, where, like, Jason Voorhees is the monster of the movie, but he's a person. He's, like, you know, theoretically kind of a person. I'm making this definition as broad as possible to try to get more episodes to talk about. So it could be either one. It could be, like, I think one of the important things about a monster is that it's something that you want to avoid, usually. Uh-huh. Like, sometimes you can fight it, but it's, like, it's scary enough that you don't want to go near it. For psychological reasons or just because it looks gross or what have you. Like, I wouldn't define a hostile Klingon ship as a monster. But on the other hand, like, an unstoppable proto-Klingon running through your ship, that's a monster. Which, right. You know, I was referencing a specific episode there, but before we get to them, before we get to that one in particular, I wanted to talk about the bad monster episodes.
Bad ones.
So the first one that really comes to mind when I think of bad monsters in Star Trek is Macrocosm. So for reference, for anyone who doesn't remember, Macrocosm is the episode where Janeway comes back to the ship, Janeway and Neelix, and the ship's all floating in space adrift. And it's full of these giant, like, viruses. And at first you think they're supposed to be insects, but then you're told that they're actually giant viruses.
Yep.
They were caused by a transporter accident, I think. But they're, like, floating all over the ship, and Janeway has to go all dive.
I don't think it was a transporter accident, because this was something that was afflicting some other colony or something like that.
I thought it was that they, like, they were helping this colony that had this disease, but the viruses weren't, like, basketball-sized at that point. They were just, like, bug-sized. And they got beamed up, and, like, the doctor did something to him that made him start growing accidentally.
Good job, doctor.
I forget exactly what the explanation for the monsters was, but I remember that Janeway, you know, basically has to go die hard on them because, like...
Yeah.
Because, like, Neelix gets, you know, stuck by one real, real early.
Yep.
And, of course, the first question that popped into my mind as we started seeing these was, like, how did these things take down the entire crew? Like... I remember, like, it was at that point where it was, like...
Because they didn't have the hazard team yet.
It was, like, making them really big. Voyager Elite Force reference right there.
Bam.
Set
phasers to frag!
Making them really big is actually a weakness, because now you can shoot them with phasers. And they, like, aren't super strong, so it's, like, it feels like a team of security officers should have been able to take care of these.
Uh-huh.
But, like, I mean... Maybe there was some plot explanation, like... Do you remember, like, was it that the crew was infected with the virus before they got huge, or did that happen afterwards?
I don't remember specifically. I don't recall, if I remember the narrative correctly of the story, though, it was, people were getting sick and whatnot, and it wasn't until later in the incubation cycle of it, not the incubation cycle, but just later on that they... got bigger, and by that time it was probably so much the crew was incapacitated by the disease they couldn't do much about it.
That's probably what it was. But one of the biggest problems with this episode is that these special effects are just kind of goofy. because, like, they're CGI, but they just look really fake. Like, there's this one scene where the doctor, like, grabs one and is fighting with it, and it's really obvious that Robert Picardo is just fighting with empty air, and they're trying desperately to paste this monster in the space between his hands.
Yep.
And it's just like, I'm sorry, guys. It's just not working.
Fail.
You're like, normally I'm very forgiving of bad special effects, you know, especially for Star Trek, because I like the original series, but your drama is sort of based around me being afraid of these monsters, and I'm just not.
I'm not afraid.
I am not frightened, sir. Give me another one. And it wasn't helped by the fact that they solved it with the same green explosion effect that they had, like, just used in a previous episode. And it was like, hey, that's the same explosion from the space station. How did it get in here?
Hey,
hang on, guys. So that one is just a pretty clear example of, if you don't have the special effects to back it up, you shouldn't just throw monsters around willy-nilly. And then the next thing that popped into my mind, this is technically not an episode, but Star Trek 2009 has that random monster sequence where, like, Kirk's
on Delta Vega.
Yeah, Kirk crashes on the ice planet, and there's a monster, and it's like, and Kirk has to run away from the monster, and you're just watching it, and you're like, well, first of all, that's the same monster J.J. Abrams uses in every movie. Like, it's very similar to the Cloverfield monster and the Super 8 monster. And it's like, I get that J.J. Abrams really likes reverse-elbowed creatures, or creatures with too many elbows, but, like, I don't know, it was weird. It was kind of strange seeing that monster, and I hadn't seen Super 8 yet, so at that point it was just Cloverfield. It was just like, that's the Cloverfield monster. How did it get on Delta Vega? Did they teleport it there after it attacked New York?
That was part of the plan. That was Operation Hammer.
Is Cloverfield a prequel to Star Trek? What's going on here, guys? But, like, that was just something that I've noticed and thought, and I was just, that whole scene feels very extraneous. And, like, the monster itself looks fine, but it's just sort of this random monster chase sequence in the middle of a sci-fi action movie that doesn't really have anything else to do with the rest of the plot, and is just sort of a way to introduce... I guess it was they felt like they needed to introduce Spock on a dramatic note, and so they had him, like, you know, come out with a torch, because that monster totally looked like it would be afraid of a, like, candle-sized torch. It's like, oh, no!
Fire. It's a very alien thing. Delta Vega.
Yeah, but it, like, it's just... There's a size thing here. Like, that torch did not look big enough to frighten away that enormous monster. You know, I don't think a grizzly bear would be frightened if I waved a candle in its face.
I think a lot of that probably has to do just with JJ's way of shooting scenes and how the scenes were written. Which a lot of the scenes, if I remember correctly, had a lot of starting out flat and then rose very sharply in action and then tapered down again.
Yeah.
A lot of those scenes are like that, if I remember correctly, in Star Trek. The Star Trek movie, anyway. Yeah. I mean, you could very easily just had Kirk, you know, wandering the wastes and, you know, falling over from being so cold, he's exhausted and whatnot, and having, you know, Spock stumble upon him, you know.
And then put him inside a Tauntaun.
And put him inside a Tauntaun, that's right. You could have done that. I mean, speaking of which, a little tangent, have you seen the video where it puts Star Trek 2009 and Star Wars A New Hope side by side?
I have not, but now I want to.
Oh, man, so... Like, it was almost like a scene for scene comparison where this guy is talking about this story, and it goes through, you know, the arc of this hero is having, which in Star Trek it's Kirk, in New Hope it is Luke Skywalker, and the words are the same for it all through the video until they get to the end where they say, you know, Star Trek, and the other one says Star Wars. But they're transposed over each other. So it sounds like it's like Star Trek Wars, you know, so it's kind of funny, and it kind of makes you go, you know what, he's right. Because a lot of it is very similar in terms of how the story unfolds and whatnot. But anyway.
Do you think the threshold counts as a monster episode? I mean, threshold's really bad in every respect, but...
Yeah. I would say no, because a monster wasn't the focus of the episode. It wasn't the threat to the crew. You know, the only thing that threatening that was happening to Tom Paris.
Although, right? he did turn into a monster.
He turned into a newt, space newt.
Yeah, but before that, he was a monster. Before that, he was all like, you know, before he went full newt, he was all like Reptile Man.
And he was sort of, like, I mean, he
running around the ship, kidnapping, like, That's my one of my favorite parts of Threshold, is when he, like, ambushes Janeway in the turbo lift, and he, like, chest bumps her. And he, like, and she falls unconscious from a chest bump, and it's like, wow, that was a...
The deadliest of monsters.
That was a pretty impressive chest bump right there.
I don't know. I feel compelled to say that it is not a monster episode, necessarily.
All right. And so this next one isn't a monster.
I don't have a good reason, though.
Well, Threshold's just really bad.
I just want to forget Threshold.
No, you can't. I'm going to keep bringing up Threshold.
Ah, my gosh.
The funniest thing about Threshold, one of my favorite parts is that... So in Threshold, they're like, Warp 10 is infinite speed.
Yes,
like,
everywhere.
You can't go faster than Warp
10. Yeah.
But, of course, this is either a retcon or just a goof, because they have had ships that have gone faster than Warp 13 before. Warp 10. Most recently, in All Good Things, Riker orders his ship to go Warp 13.
Yep.
And the funny thing about that is, can you remember who wrote... So who wrote Threshold? Do you remember who it was?
I don't remember who the writers were.
It was Brendan Braga.
Okay.
Do you remember who wrote All Good Things?
No, but I feel like it's also Brandon.
It was Ron Moore and Brandon Braga. And it's like, come on, Brian. Really? Come on. I don't know if you were responsible for that particular line of dialogue, but you figure you would remember the thing from the... From, like, the biggest episode that you ever worked on.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I have a feeling that's a big part of Brandon's claim to fame, is he was like, I totally worked on All Good Things, which is, like, the best Star Trek ending episode ever.
Nice.
But, okay, so this next one isn't technically a monster movie either, but I want to talk about it anyway. So, you guys all remember Star Trek V.
Well, we don't want to remember Star Trek
V. Yeah, but you have to.
It's kind of Threshold.
You have to remember Star Trek V. We can't forget the bad things.
Yeah, it's true. Unless you don't study history, you're doomed to get it right.
So, one of the things that I always thought was interesting about Star Trek V is that there was supposed to be, in that scene towards the end, after they've made God Alien angry, and they've decided that they're not, you know, that he's bad, there was supposed to be a sequence with a giant rock monster. But they just didn't have the money for it. They couldn't make it work.
Okay.
And it was going to be, like, chasing them, and that was the thing that was going to get shot by the Bird of Prey.
It said God gets shot.
Instead of just the hole in the ground where God apparently lives.
Okay.
And it was like... It's one of the many things that if you listen to the commentary with Shatner and his daughter, that Shatner's like, yeah, I really wish we could have done that, but we didn't have money. And I'm kind of wondering...
To what end, though?
Yeah, it's sort of like...
Why rock monster?
Yeah, that was the thing. It was like... It feels like this whole episode was very... Not episode, excuse me, movie. But this whole movie is supposed to be, like, very metaphysical and, like, not be about, like, giant rampaging, you know, destruction creatures.
Uh-huh.
So it's... I was a little confused as to why they would even want a... Like a rock monster at that point. So it's the whole point of that sequence.
Rock monster.
The whole point of that sequence is for the characters to be like, wait a minute, this isn't actually God. This is an alien, and it's like it's more of a spiritual or like at the very least like mental moment than it is a physical one. But like, I'm trying to imagine what that sequence would have been like with like the most awesome rock monster that I can visualize. Because let's assume it would have been a good rock monster. I'm imagining something kind of... I'm imagining this enormous golem-like thing with
lava coming out. I can't believe I'm going to do this, but I think I'm just going to be construed as me trying to defend Star Trek V.
Do it! Oh my gosh.
I'm going to do this.
I'm waiting for the hate mail.
But as I recall, a particular line of dialogue was that where it was quote-unquote God and then Cybok were talking, and then Cybok said something about just the god of Shakari or whatever it was wouldn't do these things.
Uh-huh.
And the god's like, Shakari, that's a thing you made up. That's why I'm imprisoned here. So it's very much that this thing was, the impression I got anyway, was somehow manifested by Cybok's thoughts or something like that, was the impression I got from it.
Hmm.
You know, that, just with that simple line of dialogue. Again, it wasn't really very clear.
No,
but that
not a lot.
That being said, this entity that's now manifest just wants to leave this place. It didn't really give any indication necessarily that he could just make things happen, you know, just like spontaneously snap his finger like Q could and, you know, have Rock Monster appear. That's not what his capabilities were. His capabilities... Yeah, exactly. He just wanted to leave and could channel lightning bolts out of his eyes.
So he's Frylock?
Yes, he is Frylock, of course.
So apparently there was a... Do you remember the episode where Barkley gets super smart?
Yes. Nth degree.
Nth degree. When they were originally, like, putting that episode together, like, in the original concept meeting, they were talking about having the aliens be, like, the same alien as the one from Star Trek V. And they were like, that was their original idea. Because, okay. You know, the aliens that made him super smart.
Yeah.
And they eventually decided not to do that because they didn't want the aliens to be, like, sinister. Because they wanted Barkley's super smartness to be a good thing.
Yeah.
And then they were, like, thinking of having it, of having, like, an offhand comment about how the alien, about, like, how the alien from Star Trek V was, like, an exiled member of this race. But I think they just decided that that would have been confusing. And so they, you know.
They would have gotten hate mail for trying to defend Star Trek V.
Yeah. So they decided not to. But I thought that was interesting. And then I guess the last thing on my list is in Nemesis. And again, this isn't really supposed to be a monster thing, but it kind of ends up being one where Riker is fighting the Reeman in, like, over the bottomless pit at the lower deck of the ship. So you try to figure out how that works. Where does this pit go, guys?
To the bowels of the ship.
But they kind of frame that sequence like it's supposed to be a monster fight. Because, like, the Reeman is all, like, underlit and, like, lives in darkness. And, like, Riker is... I don't know. I always thought that they were trying to go for a monster motif with that scene.
Kind of like the knight is in the lair of the dragon, sort of, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Although, you know... I don't know. That was sort of the impression I got from it, was that they wanted this Reeman to be a scary monster. He was not a scary monster, but they really wanted him to be.
Well, Ron Perlman did play the Beast. In what was the show called?
What show?
There was a show, I think, in, like, the late 80s or early 90s or something like that, that had, like, a Beauty and the Beast concept, but it was a TV show, and Ron Perlman was playing the Beast.
Really?
Yeah.
This is kind of a... What's the segue here?
Well, Ron Perlman plays the Viceroy.
Really?
Yeah.
That's Ron Perlman?
Yes.
Oh, wow. My mind is blown. Blown right out of everything.
There's your segue. Snap.
Bam. I was wondering if that's what the segue was. I was like, no way that was Ron Perlman.
RTK is just saying it's just Beauty and the Beast, so I guess maybe that's just what the show is called as well. But yeah, Ron Perlman totally played the Beast in there.
I don't believe it. Ron Perlman is I don't know. I don't want to think of Ron Perlman being involved with that movie. With Nemesis.
What you want and what happened or are two different things, as we've noted many a time with, like, Star Trek V and Threshold.
But things could be different. If I try hard enough, things might be different.
If you try hard. Alright. I would actually insert a rude comment there, but this is family hour.
It is a bit. I think with that in mind, we should go to a music break.
You
now
think
that,
so?
Now that I've discovered that Ron Perlman was in Nemesis, I need a few minutes to digest that.
Okay, alright. Here's a little...
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. The music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music breaks, please tune in live, 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern, only on Trek Radio.
And welcome back to All Things Trek here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
And there's a couple ways you can interact with the show here with us on All Things Trek. Myself and Oren. I mean, they can consist of sending us hate mail, like some have in the past to Oren, because everyone loves me.
You got called out this today, Bob.
Only because of confusion on how the word mystery is used.
The point is that was you they were calling out and not me.
But it was still love.
Yeah.
It was love. You don't understand.
All right.
You still understand the special relationship I have with
what,
the audience.
What is love?
What is love? Well, first, you don't hurt me, baby.
Uh-oh.
All right, so if you'd like to interact with the show, you can send us an email at allthingstrek@hotmail.com. You can also interact with us in our IRC chat room, which you can connect to, if you'd like, through the community tab on the trekradio.net website. It's by going to community and then going to IRC chat room, or with your favored IRC chat client. You can also send us a twit. Right. That is, or tweet.
A tweet.
A tweet, mind you, at allthingstrek if you want to follow us on Twitter. We need to find more clever things to say. I like the Season 8 Voyager stuff that we do.
Yeah, I'll try to come up with some more of those.
I mean, those are kind of fun. So, we were talking about monsters.
And
we actually just got done with the bad ones before the break, so we want to talk about some good ones?
Yeah, that's the plan. Alright, so... Excuse me. The first monster episode that, despite its silliness, that I actually really liked was Genesis. Okay. Which is the, and my first, I don't mean chronological order. I just mean the first one I can think of.
Okay.
And that's the one with,
Everyone's getting reverted to a much, much more base version in their DNA or something like
Something like that. We've talked about this episode before, because, like, all the old DNA is turning on, and it's turning Worf into...
Thanks, Crusher!
Yeah. It's turning Worf into a proto-Klingon, and Barclay into a spider, and all that junk.
Uh-huh.
And despite that episode's moderate degree of silliness, I do like the way that they did Worf. Like, Worf was scary in that episode.
Yep.
Although, I thought that they did sort of raise an unfortunate question of how many crew members he killed during those couple of days, because I'm sure the answer was at least a couple. But they never...
Man's gotta eat.
But they never bring that up.
Uh-huh. Oh, have you seen the Predator... mashup trailer?
I have not.
Alright, so this guy took scenes from Genesis in regards to, like, Worf and his transformation at Picard on the ship with Data, and made, like, a Predator trailer out of it. It was really good. I enjoyed it thoroughly. It's on YouTube if you want to check it out. It's just Star Trek Predator, I think, is all. There's the keywords you need in there. But it was actually really not too badly done. I enjoyed it.
Well, that's clever. Alright.
Yeah, so, what else we got?
Well, just hang on a minute. I'm not done with Genesis.
Okay.
So, like, it's good in that they did manage to make Worf an actual threatening monster. On the other hand, it's kind of silly in that it's... If they had just sent Data to fight Worf, it wouldn't have been very scary, because Data is much stronger and could have easily defeated Worf in a fight.
Yeah, but Data's the only one that was able to have the focus and presence of mind that was undergoing a physical transformation like Picard was doing to be able to come up with the medical solution.
Right. But it was still, like, it was a little contrived, because if Worf had just been in a different part of the ship, I don't know. And the next one on my list is M'Pok Nor. And as far as I'm concerned, this is the best monster episode Star Trek has ever done. Because the monster is Garak. And truly, what is more terrifying than Garak, who has decided he does not like you anymore?
it's...
Because, like, Garak, of course, is a person, right? We were talking about this earlier, about how you can have different types of monsters, and sometimes they can be people and not just, like, weird crazy things. And for anyone who doesn't remember, M'Pok Nor is the episode where they go to the station M'Pok Nor, which is, like, the duplicate of Deep Space Nine... Because they need some, like, spare parts. Oh, excuse me.
Uh-huh.
They need some spare parts for Deep Space Nine or something. And it's all broken. And there are, like, they discover these two Cardassian, like, sleeper soldiers who have, like, who are insane because of some experimental combat drugs they were given.
No, I don't think they were insane. They it was very much engineered to be a trap, I thought, for anybody who was coming onto the station. That these guys were selected for this task to be sleeper soldiers and to murder anybody that did come onto the station.
Well, no,
I thought that was their whole directive.
It's both. They were left behind as a trap, but they were left behind because they were unsuccessful experiments.
Hmm.
Like, they were killing machines, but they were not useful killing machines, because they couldn't be trusted on to obey. They couldn't be counted on to obey orders because the drug had made them unbalanced.
Huh.
So, like,
okay,
you know, so that's a thing. And then, of course, Garak gets infected with this...
Because it's a Cardassian thing. It's a Cardassian virus.
He gets infected with this weird combat thing that makes him a little bit crazy.
Yep.
And then he becomes the villain of the episode.
Yep.
And it's really well done, and it's, like... The lighting is really good, and it's justified for... It explains really well why everything is so dark. And they have a fairly good reason for splitting up, as I recall, because in a lot of movies and a lot of monster stories, it's like, let's split up, gang. It's like, you know, wouldn't it be better to stay together?
No, that's cool.
But they have, like, a really neat transition between Garak being, like, you know, just kind of going a little over the edge to try to find these two Cardassians, and then once he finally kills them, and then he just goes and, you know, becomes flat out the bad guy.
Yep.
Like, the sequence where he murders the engineer is really, really good. And then, of course...
The coil spinner thing, whatever it is?
Yeah.
Yep.
I really like that sequence. And of course, it's like a lot of good monster movies, there's a reflection going on with O'Brien and Garrick, where like O'Brien is having to face a part of himself and like have to overcome that, and the whole thing is really good. And for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that Garrick is scary as hell.
Yeah, he can be pretty out there, especially when we start talking about putting his skills to use.
Yeah,
when
exactly.
He's under the effect of, you know, this combat drug, effectively, he does become a very scary adversary just because of his spy mystique in conjunction with that, because he uses his, you know, his ability to blend into the shadows to stalk you, as it were.
Ooh, and I just,
but also because he's really smart as well.
Exactly. And I just recognize, I just remember, this is, we were talking about this last week when Kathy was telling us about the uncanny, which is like, which is, you know, Freud's definition of the familiar inside the strange, or the strange inside the familiar. That's totally what they did in that episode. Because Garrick is our friend, right? We are used to Garrick being our friend. But then suddenly,
Of course Garrick would say he's your friend.
But then he was not our friend anymore, because he was trying to kill us, and it was uncanny.
Yeah.
And it was... So, yeah, I can't gush enough about that episode. It's sometimes, depending on my mood, sometimes it's my favorite episode. Not usually, but every once in a while.
Okay.
Well, look, I can't just pick a favorite episode. It really depends on how I feel. I'm changeable like that. And so, do you...
That sounds non-committal to me.
Well, I'm a flip-flopper.
Ooh, Sam.
So I wanted to ask, do you think that the Adversary is a monster episode?
You have to remind me of the episode.
Okay, so the Adversary, quick recap, it's, they're on the Defiant, they are going to go patrol the Zenkethi border, and first of all, what's a Zenkethi, and why did we never see them again? Because in this episode, they were apparently a big deal, and the Federation fought a war with them at some point, and I think Sisko had been in it. And, like, the premise of the episode was that they had just had a change of government, and so, like, the Defiant was there to make sure that the...
Is this where Sisko becomes captain?
Yes. Yeah,
the ambassador's on there, but turns out to be a changeling?
Yeah, the ambassador turns out to be a changeling. And they have to, like, you know... This is the first episode where they come up with blood tests, which, of course, don't work. They have never worked.
But,
like, they, you know, they're hunting the changeling through the ship. Do you think that counts as a monster episode?
I want to say it does, because it has a lot of the base elements of being kind of a monster story, which is that you don't know where this entity is, and it's definitely causing trouble for you. It has the potential to kill members of your party, whatever it might be, right?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, this is an alien... This is kind of, I guess, maybe the problem I have with a lot of, I guess you could say, quote-unquote, alien monsters in Star Trek, is that a lot of the time what we define as a monster is more sentient and has a more political motivation sometimes. And the changes are a really good example of this. Has a much more political-based motivation for doing what they're doing. In this case, this changeling is on the ship because they're trying to start a war between the Federation and the Zenkethi, again, is what they're doing. Right, so I mean, it has the elements of being a monster episode in that the changeling is going around doing things to the ship, making sure that the ship continues in Zenkethi space so they can start a war. That's where it starts to kind of not be monster movie-esque anymore,
mm-hmm.
is that it's definitely much more of a politically motivated thing. So
yeah, that's fair. I mean, like, once you start thinking of the changeling as a character and not just, like, a force that needs to be avoided or evade or escaped, that's kind of... That makes it a little different. And RTK is in chat room is right. There have been a number of instances where they have brought up this alien race and made them sound really important. Like, the Sheliak. Does anyone remember the Sheliak?
You mean Tar Monster?
And, No, the Sheliak weren't tar monsters.
They totally were.
Were they? They were the ones that in...
I'm not talking about the one from Skin of Evil, mind you, but keep in mind.
No.
It very much looked like it was crumpled newspaper that had, like, tar dumped on it, what a Sheliak looked like.
Who are you to judge the crumpled newspaper monsters?
also the same show that brought us a windsock dipped in cement is the Doomsday Machine.
But, so, like, the thing that I was... What I was wondering about in this particular instance, because usually, even though, like, TNG was infamous for bringing up alien races that were a really big deal and then never coming back, But I didn't see that as often in Deep Space Nine. So do you, with all of your soft canon knowledge, did they ever do anything with the Zenkethi in like the extended, in like the novels or in Star Trek Online?
Oh man, that'd be I think a much better question for GNT. But I do think that they play a role in the Typhon Pack series of novels. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure they do. I haven't read them myself yet, because I have a lot of Trek still I have on my shelf to read. But I think that... Are you familiar with the Typhon Pact at all?
No.
So all this alien species that aren't... This is a really, really rough kind of guide to it, I suppose, or explanation. You have, like, the Federation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a bunch of other minor races that aren't a part of the Federation.
Right.
The Typhon Pact, as I understand it, is all about these other alien races coming together and forming their own kind of Federation. So, yeah. So, which they call the Typhon Pact, and it's opposed to the Federation.
Okay.
Is what it is. That's the rough kind of outline, as I understand it, of the Typhon Pact.
So the KDF, then?
No, not the KDF.
Because that's kind of what the KDF is.
The KDF is the Klingon Empire with its own, you know, I guess you could say, because they've conquered, you know, the Gorn and kind of the Noskans and the Orions and the Orions, I guess, allied themselves with them, but it's very much where the Klingons are, as perceived, are in control, from what I understand. So
right.
The Typhon Pact is very much more, I think, an alliance.
Mm, okay, all so. Right. Well, that's fair. So, and the Zenkethi are in it.
Yeah. But,
well...
It's interesting. What about the Mantrap?
The Mantrap? Ah, I forgot about the Mantrap.
I mean, that
Mantrap
has a monster. That's the definition of a monster.
That is totally a monster movie. I completely forgot about the monster, about the Mantrap. That monster is really creepy looking. You remember what it finally looks like?
It's got sucker face.
Yeah.
and it can transform.
Yes, it can.
In fact, it was playing the part of McCoy's little girlfriend, which was the other guy's wife.
I remember the episode.
As a matter of fact, that was the episode they premiered as the pilot back in the 60s.
Well, it was Star Trek. It was the first episode that was ever shown on television.
Right, exactly. That was the first one they had aired as the pilot. Mm-hmm. Was what they had done. Because they wanted to be able to put the show forward as setting the precedent not for the for shows as it is for the 60s, but as a show for itself, that it could bring that week-to-week monster sort of experience. And that's what they wanted to start off with their best foot forward, as it were,
well, also,
for that network.
Remember, like, back in the day, there was never... Like, nowadays, it's pretty much assumed that the pilot will also be the first episode, but that wasn't always true. Like, there was a period of television where very often the pilot was never aired. And, like, you know, like, The Cage was never really meant to be aired. And I'm a little surprised that they decided to air Where No Man Has Gone Before, personally, because it's nothing like Mantrap.
Nope.
Like, if you look at Mantrap and compare it to Where No Man Has Gone Before, the uniforms look different, the characters are different, Spock's eyebrows are different, everything is different. The phasers even look different. So, like, I was very surprised that they... Not only did they air it, but they aired it, like, as the third episode. So, like, you're watching, there's Mantrap, and there's Charlie X... And then there's No Man Has Gone Before. I'm like, what happened? Everything is different now. And, like, if I was watching that without...
Two steps forward, then three steps backwards.
If I was watching that episode without the benefit of the internet to look up what was going on, I would be so confused. I should ask... Yep. I wonder if anyone actually was. I should ask my mom. Let's see. Ask her if she remembers watching them in that order. But then again, she watched them in, like, reruns, so who knows.
Well... Well, reruns are usually aired in order as well.
It's true, but we don't know what point she came in on the cycle.
That's true.
All right, so I think that's about all I got for monsters.
I'm sure there's more out there.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are. I don't know. I was having a really hard time researching this topic for some reason. Episodes were not coming to mind, and I guess, like, as a rule, Star Trek's not really a big monster show. It's just not a thing that they do all that much.
Uh huh. Well, what are some of the rules of monsters, then, that we, you know, should be looking out for?
Well, I guess, to go down, like, dramatically speaking, and I guess this sort of, ties into which episodes were good and which ones were bad. I mean, obviously the monsters need to be scary.
Right.
That's why Macrocosm failed. They're not scary. They don't look scary. They just look silly.
The tentacle basketball.
You know, and, like, there's, you know, there has to be some aura of menace around them, which is why, like, Garrick and Worf make really good monsters, because they were scary, whereas basketball monsters, not so much.
In the case of Garrick, it was a very subtle transformation, I felt, until he finally killed somebody. You didn't realize what was going on. That it was kind of like you're putting the pieces together. With Worf, it was very much you didn't see him in his entirety until he was actually standing under a like a shaft of light. You didn't see what he was.
Well, like,
all you know is this thing going running around the ship.
Well, like, you know, Steven Spielberg will tell you that you never show them the whole monster, like, until the very end you get to see it once. But, you know, there's sort of the general rule of monsters is that nothing that the filmmakers can make will be as scary as the thing you imagine. So that's definitely a rule that I feel like they did pretty well in both Empok Nor and Genesis.
Uh-huh.
And to a lesser extent, Adversary. Like, Adversary is, like, kind of iffy, but if we are looking at it as a monster episode, I think they followed those rules fairly well. Different kind of monster, obviously. Because the changeling in Adversary isn't really in like murdering people. It's just, you know, it has this objective that they don't want it to accomplish because they don't want to start a war.
Right.
So I think, like, you know, I think that, and I think that a lot of the monsters that we were talking about so far, or at least the one from Macrocosm, failed because of budget issues. It was just like they just didn't have enough money.
That makes sense.
And, like, I think that Mantrap had a very good way of getting around that, was that they just had the monster be played by an actress for most of the movie, or for most of the episode, and then at the very end they revealed it. But I think that the big thing about the Mantrap monster, the reason it was so scary-looking, was that it didn't have to move. It was just basically a prop. Like, it was revealed...
like a rubber mask.
Right, but it was revealed and then it died. Like, we never had to see it running around or walking. It didn't... You know, I think that the, Skin of Evil is totally a monster episode. How did I forget Skin of Evil? It's like,
did we forget it?
It's the one where Tashiyar dies. You figure I would have remembered that.
That's true,
and
the whole premise of that monster as well was that it fed off of negative emotions. They got a kick out of it anyway, at least, of people's fear and whatnot. So.
It's the opposite of the virus that...
It was actually... God knows how they did it, but it was actually all of the... What could be considered negative thought, emotion, and feeling from an alien race, right? They had developed some sort of way of being able to rid themselves of it, and it ended up being that tar monster.
That sounds right. I remember having a really hard time following exactly what that tar monster was supposed to be. Like, I remember...
Well, that was what the tar monster was saying.
Yeah, I remember that Picard...
Which has a name. I forget what his name is, though.
I remember that Picard beamed down and talked to him, and I remember before that when I... Because the first time I watched that episode, I was fairly young, and I was trying to figure out why the phasers didn't work on him. Because I was just like, but they shot him with the phaser. Why is it just a tar man?
They just ate the phaser energy. Nom 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 nom. Whatever grown boy needs.
All right, but I won't. All right, so I think this is about. I think we can segue into talking about kids for our last half hour.
Some more monsters.
That joke is tired. The joke is tired, Bob. Put it to bed.
It's so easy.
So do you remember there being there were no, like, reoccurring kid main characters in TOS, were there?
No.
Like, I remember the two episodes that I actually remember there being kids in TOS, I'm sure there were more, but the two that I remember off the top of my head are Muri and The Children Shall Lead.
Operation Annihilate also.
What was Operation Annihilate?
Had Kirk's nephew.
Oh, did it?
Peter.
I forgot about that. Wasn't that the one where it was Operation Annihilate with an exclamation mark?
Maybe.
It was like, Operation Annihilate!
Probably.
Wait,
RTK's got some more, actually, in the chat room for monsters.
Says,
I missed some of the show, but did you talk about Devil in the Dark or the Horda? Oh, that's also a good one.
Yeah, see, we're just bad. We're bad at this. We can't... What was Devil in the Dark? Remind me of that one.
Devil with the Horta?
Oh, okay, that is the Horta. Okay. I just didn't remember the name of the episode.
They go to this place that's rich in some sort of mineral, and miners are dying.
Yeah, I know what the Horta is.
But that's because they had wandered into, like, one of the egg chambers and were smashing a bunch of eggs or whatever it was.
They're being awful rude.
Yeah, that's a good monster one, actually. And that's also really good in the respect that they find out that it's not just, you know, a monster killing willy-nilly, but it's a monster that is protecting its young.
Exactly.
It's very much an animal that is, it's just, it is just an animal who is trying to protect its children, more or less, is what it's doing.
Yeah, and I think that it was also helped by the fact that it was, like, visually, it was effective, but not overambitious. It was like, you know, it looked like some kind of weird rock monster. Speaking of rock monsters, flashback to Star Trek V for a minute there.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it wasn't like, it looked like it was supposed to look, but it didn't look like, it wasn't like they were putting some guy in a Godzilla suit. You know, it didn't look really goofy. And I think that's definitely a really good example of a monster episode where they had their budget and they were able to work within it to make something good happen.
Uh-huh.
They didn't try to overshoot like they have a couple of times.
Yeah.
But the two episodes for...
I feel that there are more for TOS.
TOS probably had more of them than we can remember. Do you think Doomsday Machine is a monster episode?
Oh, absolutely.
This you know, it's this monster, yes, outside the ship?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Definitely. I really like Doomsday Machine. Talked a lot about that episode.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is literally destroying worlds.
And it's like pretty much...
In that case, it was a monster manufactured, is what it was, as opposed to one that was... Well, as far as we know, anyway, it wasn't born of space. It was definitely put together, and from what they understood of it, if I remember correctly, it had come from somewhere way far away.
Another galaxy.
Another galaxy or something. It had wandered over here and blown up planets.
See, it's interesting because I consider the Doomsday Machine a monster episode, but I wouldn't consider Balance of Terror a monster episode, even though it's...
Balance of Terror was a submarine fight.
Yes, it was. But, you know, in both instances, they're dealing with another very powerful, very dangerous spaceship.
Yeah.
But I think the clear difference is that the Romulans are doing what they're doing out of, like, you know, as you were talking earlier, they have, like, a political motivation, whereas the Planet Eater... is just doing what it does. You know? And I think that's... Mm-hmm.
Crystalline Entity.
We are so bad.
We are so bad at this.
We have turned in our podcasting license. we forgot the Crystalline Entity.
Crystalline Entity is also another good one.
But I think
that is very much born of space.
Exactly.
We know that. It is a cosmozoan, I think is actually what the term is called, where it is just doing what it does, but it's causing... destruction on such a wide level that it's considered, you know, terrible. And they're actually able to pseudo-communicate with it. And so
they're getting there until that lady is like, no, I'm going to break it. So I heard the Crystalline Entity is a really frustrating boss fight in Stowe. I know you love that boss fight.
Oh, man. Well, what I do, one, it's time-gated, so, but I definitely jump into it when I can, because I do enjoy... It's probably one of the few things that actually feels like an actual, I guess you could say, raid encounter in Star Trek Online. I enjoy it for that because of its difficulty factor. Now, that being said, it is really easy to do this encounter. Granted, you actually have one guy doling out the orders of what to do. And I happen to know how the encounter goes. I happen to know, well, I should say, I have a winning strategy for how it goes. So typically when I jump into that, I'm just like, anybody who wants to do this the right way, follow me over this way. And I have some people who come with me, typically about 10 or so, and we do it, and it works. And then we get done in, like, you know, about 5 minutes.
Oh. Okay.
And everyone else goes hacking away for the next, like, hour or so in other instances. I can't get it done. So, yeah.
Fair enough. All right. But I think I hit on something a minute ago before we got on the Star Trek Online tangent, which was that one of the things that I think helps define a monster is something that is just sort of doing what it does without any kind of, without, like, without a will. It's like, it doesn't have...
It's instinctual.
Yeah, it hasn't made a decision to do what it's doing. It just does what it does. Which is... And, like, very often, when it's revealed that it's doing things for... because of its own reasons, as opposed to just out of instinct, it is... That's often the point where it stops being the monster. Like the Horta, for example.
Okay. Yeah.
Or maybe even the Crystalline Entity, if it hadn't exploded... Like, because they were getting to communicate with it, and they were at least going to try to convince it to, like, use a different food source that wouldn't involve killing a bunch of...
Well, they were making the initial point of contact, and they're figuring out how to talk to it, which is through the graviton pulses, but unfortunately, you know, Dr. Marr and her rampage of revenge...
She was mad!
She was mad.
She had things to do.
Who's the real monster?
Oh! You know, 'twas Beauty killed the Beast and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, speaking of everyone doing what anyone else says, this is a quick reference back to your Star Trek Online thing. I'm actually really excited to try this game called Artemis. I'm going to be trying that tomorrow, hopefully.
Yes.
So Artemis...
Really? Hmm? Tomorrow?
Yeah, that's the plan.
When?
Like around noon.
Hmm.
You'll probably be working.
Well, no, I'd probably normally be sleeping during that time.
Well,
but I might have to make an exception for Artemis.
Well, I'll send you a Facebook thing.
Okay.
If you see if you're awake. But it's a really cool-looking game where, like, everyone play... Each person plays, like, a different console on the bridge of a starship.
Yep.
And then, you can... It's almost freeware. Like, you can basically... Like, you can pay...
But you still have to buy it, but it gives you 6 licenses, right? Is it 6?
Sort of. But once you've bought it, you can basically... It's basically the honor system. It's like, you can download it as many times as you want.
Okay.
And you can just copy it and give it to as many people as you want. So it's sort of like... It's just sort of like, you know, the guy who made it, because it's just like one guy. It's like, you know, when there's a group of people playing, hopefully one of them is paid for it.
Hopefully.
And it's $40. It is a very reasonable price. So it just looks really cool. So again, I recommend everyone who likes Star Trek to check out Artemis. Like, if you liked Bridge Commander but wanted to have friends instead of NPCs, I would check out Artemis. And I'm really hoping there's a PvP aspect to it. I don't know if there is or not, but I would totally do that.
That'd be really cool. It's what I hope Star Trek Online would be. But anyway.
There's lots of things we hope Star Trek Online would be.
Yeah. They sigh. Anyway. Is there any other monster stuff that we can think of?
Well, a minute ago I would have said no, but then we were like, wait a minute, crystalline entity,
Doomsday Machine, the Horta thing, RTK.
RTK is being a real trooper in the chat room. He's almost completely alone. He's had one or two other chats, but he's soldiering bravely on.
It's true. I'm probing the depths of my Trek knowledge now from all the series.
All right, we got monsters. Think of more TOS stuff, because apparently so many of them are TOS. I haven't thought of... Like, I'm trying to think of any more DS9 monsters, and... Nothing is coming to mind.
Let's move on to Children.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay.
Lethian episode from Deep Space Nine. The one where Bashir gets, like, zapped. That's kind of a monster episode. Because he's, like, running around the station that turns out to be his own mind, and it's, like, you know, kind of a monster.
In a Nightmare on Elm Street kind of way, I could see that.
Well, that's totally a monster movie. Oh, and Captain H in the chat room is asking, what about the Borg? I don't know if I qualify those guys as a monster movie.
If you wanted to label them just as zombies, maybe.
Yeah, they're kind of monsters in, like, First Contact and Voyager sometimes. But in TNG, they were usually a little more complicated than that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Also, the Borg involves, like, a consciousness more than, like... You know, it's a collective consciousness, but they are, you know, they're not going about this on instinct. They have a defined set of goals that they want to achieve.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not really sure if I would look at the Borg as monsters, per se. I mean, more of it... I don't know, I have a really hard time with that one.
I mean, it's an interesting point. I can see the argument made.
So can I. I have a really hard time, though, classifying the Borg. It's because there's been such an inundation, I think, of the Borg, is what it is. Because when I think monsters, it's something that doesn't come up a whole lot.
Yeah.
At least the same thing doesn't come up a whole lot. You can have different kinds of monsters. But we've seen the Borg so much in Star Trek that it's really hard to take them and label them as a monster, per se, I think. In the context of this conversation, at least. I mean, are they monsters in the regard, in the aspect that they're, you know, going out and assembling entire civilizations and stuff? Yeah, sure, absolutely. That would be a monstrous thing to do.
You're a monster!
Yeah, so, in the context of this conversation, no. I would not label them as monsters.
Don't think so? Alright,
no. For their first, or well, actually, not for their first appearance, I would, for Best of Both Worlds, I would classify them as a monster.
Hmm. You think so?
I would for that instance, but I wouldn't outside of that so much. Especially when we start getting to, well, when we have Hugh later.
Yeah.
And then anything Voyager does.
Yeah.
Species 8472!
Do you think they're monsters?
Well, I want to talk about it at least, because it just came to mind.
Yeah, that's true. I'd say you could qualify them as...
I mean, when we first see them in Scorpion, yes. Well, later on, within the flesh, no.
Well, they're all, like, scary and tripod-ish.
Yeah, exactly. They are a very quote unquote alien appearance, and they are doing very destructive things to an adversary that we're familiar with, which is the Borg. Right? You know, flower power, you know, shoot beam thing destroys planets. You know, that is some scary stuff that's going on there. Right.
It's true.
Yeah, like, so I would classify that as a monster.
And like we really don't know like why they're doing what they're doing. And it's hard for us to, like, at least when they first show up in Scorpion, it's like we don't really know what level of consciousness they have. Uh-huh. Like, it's hard to figure out, are these...
And they come from a very alien realm too.
Mm-hmm.
Fluidic space.
A realm full of water.
Well, I don't know if it's water necessarily.
It's some kind of liquid.
It is some kind of liquid. We don't know what the... But, I would, for first encounter, yes, totally a monster kind of aspect to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it very much in the same respect that they are, not instinctually, mind you, but they're defending themselves from Borg incursion, and Voyager's got in the way.
What about the Gorn that Kirk fights? Do you think that counts as a monster?
No,
I don't think. I agree. I don't think so either. Because he's obviously a sentient being. He's doing things for his own reasons.
The Gorn's the captain of its own starship, and
right.
You know is
and he's
defending
clearly,
against what has been interpreted as, you know, an incursion into Gorn space.
Although we didn't know that at the beginning. As far as we knew at that point, they just attacked the colony.
Yeah.
But he's using tools and stuff. You know, he's not just like rampaging around trying to kill Kirk.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think of some of the monster movies I've seen. Again, a lot of B sci-fi, mind you,
mm-hmm.
B movie sci-fi, and some of the quote unquote monsters that they have in those movies can be, you know, sentient and have the ability to use tools and whatnot. But I think maybe it depends upon how they're using them is how we define the monster, I suppose. Maybe.
Is it starting to feel like our B-Cast episode again? Where you're like, is this B-Cast? Is he B-Cast? I don't know.
You know, kind of like what RTK is saying, I think there are some elements that would qualify it as monster. Some of the things, anyway, is monster, but others where you go, well, it's not really... Again, maybe this is because of the premise of Star Trek, which is really more... A lot of things that happen... Or a number of things that happen anyway are politically motivated, or are supposed to be sending a social message of some sort to get
mm-hmm.
conversation going on a particular topic, whatever it might be. So that maybe could be a contributing factor to why it's harder to say this is a monster, this isn't a monster.
Right.
So things like that, I would suppose. I would suppose.
Speaking of monsters, how about Wesley Crusher? I'm stealing your joke, Bob. It's mine now. I am taking it and making my own.
Okay, alright. As an actual monster?
Now we're talking about kids.
Well, right, so right, like I said, as an actual monster.
We're never going to get past
Zing, I took it back. How do you like me now? Wesley Crusher. I don't know, I people have a problem with Wesley Crusher because I think they're jealous.
Really?
I think jealousy
is the problem with Wesley Crusher?
Well, it's not Wesley Crusher's problem. It's everyone else's problem with Wesley Crusher.
That's a bold statement, sir. This is a
real
Star Trek
fan. It's a kid who is, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say super smart, but has, I think, the ability to recognize a lot of different elements and put them together.
Uh-huh.
Right? And that can be intimidating to people.
Yeah, but I don't know. Is it, all right, so this is weird.
I mean, I can understand the complaint, because I have the complaint a lot with, like, Japanese anime, for instance, where you have a bunch of kids who are, like, 12, 13, 14, 15, maybe 16, going off and, you know, with wielding huge swords and fighting monsters. It's just like, this isn't a practical situation, guys. I want to see, you know, like... something a little more realistic happened. That being said, there are certainly, you know, prodigal people. You know, we have them in music, for instance, where, you know, someone is a prodigy with the piano or the trumpet or whatever it might be.
Sure.
Right? Those are within society. That being said, I don't see why we couldn't have a prodigy child on a starship that is the, you know...
Yeah, but what is he... Usually, if you're, like, you know, a savant in something, like... you know, like, for example, like, the kid who played, the kid who was, he was in Heroes, and he's a piano, he's like a pianist savant. You know, he's a really, really talented piano player. He's like Mozart-level talented. In fact, Mozart himself was a child prodigy piano player. But he is really, really talented at one thing, which is piano playing. Whereas the problem with Wesley is that he's good at everything. Like, it's basically like, if you think of it in RPG terms, he's good at anything that requires an intelligence role. It's like, he isn't treated... Like, if someone was actually that smart, they would get the worldwide attention that, like, that music savants do. Like, when a kid is that good at an instrument, they are, like, front page news in the music community. It's like, look, we have discovered something very rare. This person has an unusual gift. But with Wesley, it's like, yeah, he's smart. Someday he could go to the academy. And it's like, why isn't he immediately being fast-tracked into, like, you know, the most gifted scientist programs? So it's like...
Well, it could be that, you know, in the 24th century, a lot of kids are maybe just that way. But we see him really driving and pushing himself a lot of the time, right?
I mean, I'm just saying... I
mean, especially in Evolution, where he creates sentient robots, right? The nanites, right? He's asleep, you know, the next day or whatever it is, at his study with the nanite, you know, sensor thingamajig that he's got in front of him. So...
He's just... He's problematic because he's too smart. Like, he shouldn't be... he doesn't have the experience to know that many things, and it's just weird.
I don't think it's... He knows a lot of stuff, But...
Hang on, we may be having technical problems.
Uh-oh.
Okay, something happened. Yeah, I guess no one can hear us right now. That's unfortunate.
Why that happened? We still have internet, right?
We still have internet. Yeah, I mean, we're getting people in the chat room saying that they can't hear us. We should, That's weird.
That is weird.
I don't know what's going on here. Bob, fix it. Are we back? Maybe?
Not yet.
Maybe we will be back later.
Log in the server.
You're listening to the podcast and archive of all things Trek. The music breaks have been cut out due to copyright reasons. If you'd like to hear the music breaks, please tune in live 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern, only on Trek Radio.
And we're back here on TrekRadio.net. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren, because, you know, we can't have an All Things Trek show without some kind of catastrophic tech failure.
God, no kidding. Well, it wasn't catastrophic. It was catastrophic, we wouldn't be here so soon.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
I mean, catastrophic, I think, has to be 10 minutes or longer.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm just saying.
I have no idea at what point we dropped out, or how much of our discussion of Wesley Crusher they heard or didn't hear. But since we have about 10 minutes left.
Well, at least I have culpable deniability now.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe you didn't say all those things.
Well, we have 10 minutes left. What do you want to do?
Well, I mean, if we talk a little bit more about Wesley Crusher, we're definitely, I think, going to have to make the children of Star Trek its own topic.
We could probably combine it with something else, I think.
Well, I mean, probably next week. Come up with some, you know. We will come up with something, but I... All right, he's
last thing was Mozart was a prodigy, so they did hear something about Wesley Crusher.
Right, okay, so they heard all the things you said. They didn't hear all the things I said. All right, so...
That was part of my plan.
Oh. Thanks, Bob. All right, so, like... I think the point I was making at that point was that if Wesley is actually supposed to be a child prodigy, like, on the level that he's shown to be, people should be making a really big deal out of him. Like... Because he's just way too smart, and he can, like, figure out all this stuff, and he can, like, invent sentient robots by accident, and take over the ship, and figure out how to make a broken warp core, make a little warp jump. He can figure out how to do all these things that, like, he shouldn't have the expertise to do all that. And then, of course, there's also the fact that he's just not... He's fairly annoying when it comes right down to it. He doesn't act like a kid. in how smart he is.
Look who his friends are.
Well, yeah. He doesn't have any friends. He hangs out with a bunch of adults who, you know, sort of tolerate him on good days.
Yeah.
So I think
back to your class days. You know, when you were in grade school.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, at least I had this experience. There were things that you did in class. I mean, granted, public education is, I think, in my opinion, a bit of a joke anyway. A lot of things that you can just do them anyway. But whole lowest common denominator thing, all that stuff. But there would always be one or two other kids in the class who, no matter what subject material you threw at them, they could just do it, whether you were in shop or it was English class or it might be. I very much went to school with those kinds of people, where they, no matter what subject you threw them into, they could just do it, and they would get the A, and they would proceed on, right? And they weren't necessarily fast-tracked anywhere. They could be. They just weren't.
Yeah, but, like, you know, it's one thing where, like, you know, I was pretty good at history, right? Like, I was really... I always got A's in my history class. But it's one thing, you know, for me to be really good at history. It's another, like, you know, if I had come in the next day with, like, and I'd written a paper that completely changed the way people thought of ancient Egypt, I think at that point people might have taken me a little more seriously. And I, it would have been, you know, this isn't like I wrote a really awesome 10-page report on King Tut. This is like I explained how aliens actually built the pyramids and presented incontrovertible proof. You know, that's the level of stuff we're talking about that Wesley is doing. There's a question of degrees here, which is why I don't have a problem with Wesley in the later episodes that he's in. Like, in the episode where he and Picard crash on the moon together and he has to figure out how to get into the water. I like him just fine in that episode. Or in the episode where he... Or in the one where he's, you know, at the academy and it's the investigation episode into...
Well, one, Gene had a lot of the creative control over Wesley in the first season, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this is part of our problem. For one, in regards to Wesley. Especially since he has said, as far as I know, he said that he very much saw himself as Wesley, right?
Did he?
I believe so. He was trying to model Wesley after himself, anyway. That's what I understand.
Oh, boy.
So maybe that screams of narcissism.
So Wesley is a Mary Sue, then, is what you're saying.
Perhaps.
I had never thought of it that way.
I'm saying.
This opens up entirely new worlds.
But Gene had a lot of the creative control, especially during season one, right?
Yeah.
And, one, we all know that season one is hailed as one of the worst seasons, right?
Even one of. Just the worst season.
Just the worst, yeah. Season two was a little bit better. It was a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they
we had Bearded Riker.
And then they fired Colin Maurice and hired Michael Piller, and everything was better.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So, yeah. But, so maybe I think that's what we're getting hung up on here, maybe, is just what we have with Wesley season one and then what we have later.
Well, that's because Wesley barely does anything after season one and two. Like, he's around, but he's very minimal after that. And then he mainly comes up, like, in the episode where he, you know, gets to where he and Picard crash on the moon, and in the episode where he's actually at the academy, and then the episode where he comes back from the academy. So, like, most of the Wesley experience we have is in seasons one and two.
Yeah.
And he's just like, why would we don't want him around? We don't like him. And then the fact that he was made an ensign was also just like...
Acting ensign.
Well, then a real ensign without ever going through the academy. That I can totally understand why that bothers people, because that is so against any kind of procedure. And it's just like, you know, no, I don't care how smart you are. You don't get to be an officer on a ship without some kind of formal training. It's one of the reasons I really like Valiant, because Valiant is like a ship full of Wesley Crushers, and it like shows us how that ship would actually work.
Yeah.
Like, I've talked about Valiant before, and I'll probably talk about it again next week.
That was a while ago.
Yeah, but I really like Valiant, because it's like, you know, you have all these characters in Valiant who, like, basically they know what they're supposed to be doing, but they don't have the experience to actually do it. So, like, you have the captain who he knows that as a captain, he's supposed to be there for his crew members, and he's supposed to work hard and, like, carry the ship on his back, basically. And it's like... And you're right, RTK. Valiant, those characters have a legit reason to be where they are, which is that it was a training mission that went horribly wrong.
No, that's cool, bro. You can totally take the Dominion.
But then, like, the effect this captain actually has, because he doesn't have the experience or the training, is that
the cadet captain
is that instead of being Picard, which is what he's trying to be, he ends up being really nosy into other people's business and like taking stims to stay awake when he really doesn't have to. And then you have the first officer lady who is like, she knows that as the first officer, it's her job to be like a firewall between the crew and the captain and to, you know, allow the captain to maintain his distance. And so that she, you know, she can come down on the crew when the captain needs to be, you know, more beloved, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but instead of being like the discipline of the crew that the way Riker usually is, she just comes off as being a bitch that no one likes.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, and again, it's a really clear example of what happens when you have these characters who know academically what they're supposed to be doing, but don't
have practical experience.
They don't have the practical experience or the training to actually do it. You know, you can read about it in a book, and then you can actually try to do it.
Uh-huh.
All right, so I think we're about at our time.
We are almost up at our time. We got 2 minutes, so I dare you to fill 2 minutes worth of air. 1 minute worth of air.
That's all I got.
You gotta try harder than that, bro.
No, that's all I got.
Come on, bro. I know you got it in you. Eye of the tiger. Eye of the tiger.
I'm not gonna sing Eye of the tiger.
Oh, dang.
Alright, thank you all for joining us on our show. We will see you next week. We will talk about Star Trek Children and something else.
And something else.
We haven't decided. That's gonna be Bob's choice. Bob can decide what that's gonna be.
Oh, man.
Thank you for joining us in the chat room. You few who are there. You few, you brave.